Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am your host, Corey Fleck, and I am happy to report that we will be, well, talking about a wide range of markets because it sure seems like there is a lot of liquidity still sloshing around the financial world. I want to wish, first and foremost, everyone in Canada a happy Canada Day, and coming up July 4th for everyone down in the U.S. I am kicking off this show with Rick Bensignor, the founder and editor of Bensignor Investment Strategies. And Rick, I want to throw kind of a general question your way that deals with where's the risk, where's the reward when we look at financial markets where we have U.S. equity markets close to all-time highs, bonds, those are at levels that we haven't seen in multiple years. You look at something like TLT, and that's close to breaking out. And we also have gold at a six-year high. We're seeing money come into risk on, risk off. Where do you see the risk and reward? Let's start off with U.S. markets.
All right, Corey. Well, thanks for having me on again. For U.S. markets, I still think there's upside to the equity market. Our S&P target is 30.32, and that's not a sell-all level. It's just kind of the next target that we think once we stop playing with this now triple high area and in around 29.50 in the S&P, we'll kind of quickly skirt higher to over 3,000. At 30.32, I probably take some exposure off. But that's, you know, look, from where we are now at 29.40 or so, it's still almost 100 points, 3%. It's not huge. But I'm still willing to, just a week ago, we told institutional players to up U.S. equity exposure again. And so I'm willing to lay out odds that, you know, 2-to-1 odds that the market continues higher than gets down under, let's say, the 27.25 level, which is where we've had a double bottom so far this year.
So, Rick, let me jump in here quickly, because if you're trying to play for, say, that 3% move to that 30-32 level, does that mean that this bull market is getting a little long in the tooth, having such a short near-term target?
Well, it's a near-term target for, look, I deal with lots of hedge funds, and 3% is actually a lot to them. So, you know, we try to tactically play the moves that we see and what's the likely course of action in whatever the next move is. And I'll still say the next move is likely higher than lower. But 30.32 is a tactical target. It's not a strategic target. I'd put a strategic target something probably in the 3,100, the upper 31 handle, maybe close to 3,200. And up there, then I probably start thinking that we're long in the tooth. But as most people know, and look, I am a market timer. I do what is said can't be done, which is time the market. And the reality is that as good as I am at doing this, and as good as there are some people who can do this, it's still a very difficult game. The thing that I think you have to that investors should remember, and especially individual investors, is that even though you're generally long equities, you can get out or at least hedge your position very quickly these days with lots of different instruments. So it doesn't, you shouldn't have to think of this like, well, I've got to sell out 30 different names. You know, if I think this is kind of the end of the bull market, I got to sell out 30 names. Well, no, you don't. You know, you could short spiders for a certain percentage of your portfolio. You could buy the ETF instead of shorting spiders if you don't want to short. You buy the ETF with the ticker symbol SH. That's an ETF that when you buy that, you are short the S&P. So, you know, and you can do any dollar size you want because these are very liquid. So let's assume the average person doesn't have a futures account. He's not going to short S&Ps in the futures markets, but you can still hedge your exposure very quickly in the market that if something goes wrong, you can get that that locked in hedge very quickly. So even though here on the institutional side, I'm saying, you know, we still have another 3% before the next level to contend with, it's I'm basically saying you don't have to be worried until and unless we got under, let's see, one round numbers, 2,700, 27.25, because we've sold off twice. We've made it abundantly clear to our clients, both individual investor clients through inthenotrader.com, and also to my individual, not to individual, to institutional clients, that the December low, which so many people called as a bear market and sell the rally off of there, we have been so clear that that not only did not initiate a bear market, but that it was the bottom for all major global equity indices. And we told them that before mid-January. So that, you know, we still able to capture hundreds, the bulk of the rally this year. And again, I think there's more to come. So, you know, if you're an individual investor and you're saying, is this, it's a 10-year-old bull market, you know, we have a triple top kind of near 29.50, I'm not comfortable adding exposure. That's fine. I get that. But it doesn't mean you should be selling out either. And there's nothing wrong with holding your longs and, you know, picking a certain level that if we break down underneath, you want to hedge your book. And there's very easy ways to do that. So, you know, from here, we're talking a little over 200 S&P points. And, you know, in the scheme of things, I think that's not a heck of a lot to have to risk in order to just get comfortable in staying with, at least stay with what you got. If you're not comfortable putting more money in, at least stay with what you got.
Okay. Hey, that's pretty straightforward. I appreciate those comments there, Rick. Can I also just get a quick comment regarding, you mentioned that you time the market, and I know a lot of timing the market does involve reading charts, but what are some of the key factors outside of the charts that you're paying the most attention to?
Well, when I do look at shorts, Corey, I look at them in a way that most people don't. I don't use standard technical analysis to help make my decisions. I use other models that are more geared for timing. And the other element that I'm really good at bringing into this picture is bringing the whole concept of behavioral finance theory, which I know very well, I was the first to have taught it at NYU, is taking the concepts of bad decision-making that human beings do, and which of course includes portfolio managers, and exploiting their ill-timed decisions to take advantage of that. So a lot of what I look at in the charts is beyond RSIs and MACDs and, you know, stochastics and moving averages, that kind of is more common. And I have access to models that I pay for, and they're, you know, they're not inexpensive, that institutions use to better time the likelihood that you have an exhaustion of trend. And that's how I've been able to buy stuff kind of close to lows and sell stuff sometimes, you know, very close to their real turning point, at the high. And the an example I often give people is if you watch a stock go from 50 to, let's say, $100 a share, it pulls back to 80, rallies to the upper 90s, and then pulls back under 80, people will say, hey, double top near 100. We've pulled back through the lowest low in between those two peaks. Time to get out. That's a real double top. And that would likely be correct, except by the time you sell, you've now sold 20% off of the high. If you don't get out until you've seen a 20% move down, and let's say you don't get in after a low has been made until you're comfortable enough that it's actually the low and you lose 20% there, you've probably, you know, you've given up, let's just say, 60% to 70% of the, or better said, 30% to 40% of the move in either direction, you've missed just by simply waiting for confirmation. The models I use get me much closer to selling near the real peaks or buying near the real bottoms. And again, you know, these are not everyday models; they're not easily accessible. They cost a fair clip of money, but that's how I can put up the numbers like I do. And through June 15th. this year. We'll get, you know, now that the market's closed, I'll update again this weekend for the official first six months of the year. But, you know, my institutional newsletter is up 52.9% year to date as of June 15th, simply because we know how to time markets, and we play all markets globally. It's, you know, if I see something in Japan, I'll play it in Japan. It's it doesn't matter to me. It's where I can find opportunity.
Hey, that's a great return so far just through this year. And yeah. In all fairness, I remember chatting with you at the tail end of last year, and you did come on the show and say, this is looking like a bottom for global markets. And we have seen a strong rebound from there. Now, let's also look at the Treasury market. TLT is close to breaking out, as I mentioned. We have the 10-year right around 2%. How are you playing this market?
So over the last month or so, I've told clients that anywhere from about 2.15% down to 2.05%, I'm very content pulling in some profits of having been long bonds. And I can live with probably yields getting down to as low as about 1.95, which is only 5 basis points away. So it's really not far away, because we closed exactly at 2% today. And still think it's within the context of where bonds can make a short-term top. I think there's a decent chance that sometime over the summer we get up to 2.23. It's not a huge move. It's, you know, about 0.25% from where we are, but that would be my first kind of target on the upside for a bounce in yields. And as I say, I don't really want to see it get much lower than 1.95. If it gets lower than 1.95, I'll have to dig more into trying to exactly figure out where, you know, a downside target would be that's not essentially the lows somewhere in and around 1.4%. There's probably somewhere in between, but there's not a heck of a lot on the charts in between the double bottom we made between 2012 and 2016, just about 1.4%, and where we are now at 2%.
So might we be going down to that level?
Might we be? It's possible. I didn't expect us to get much below 2%. So if we did that, I would say that was not within the realm of what I expected at all. But when you look at the global interest rate picture and how many countries actually charge you money to put money in the bank instead of pay you money to put money in the bank, you know, essentially negative interest rates, the U.S. is the one place that you actually do get yield on a high-quality piece of paper that you know you're going to get paid back. And that keeps driving buyers to this market and pushing yields lower because everywhere else you can't get it. Now, a lot of that is the currency differential, but it's not 100% the currency differential. And there's more and more people saying that, you know, receiving interest on your money is really a thing of the past. And whether the U.S. goes to zero or not is not important, and more to the thought of rates are going to, it's just kind of the new way the world works, and that you don't get a return in the market as far as yield. But that does mean you could still theoretically, if you still have a bull market in bonds, and of course they move opposite to interest rates. So as interest rates go down, the price of bonds go up. So bonds you own are making money. Bonds you would purchase would make money if the bull market continued and we see this lower interest rate scenario. The problem becomes when those bonds come to expiration, and then you have to reinvest at very low rates. But I think this is still part of a long-term bottoming type formation for yields. And, you know, right here, 2%, I'm really not doing much other than, again, being happy to take some off the table. If I've sold too early, that's okay. That's not the worst thing in the world. But I don't really want to see yields get much lower and still think that there's some chance that they're close to a top.
Let's also switch focus here to gold. Gold is at a 6-year high. It finally broke out from that about 1350 to 1380, whatever level you want to use, resistance, and it held there into the end of the month, and it was a strong month. Gold moved over $100 this month, finally started to see some volatility and some excitement here. What are your thoughts on the gold market?
So in general, I'm a fan of gold. We've been long gold since 1295 for institutional clients. And we put that out as more of as an investment idea than as a trade. Most trades, you know, if you make anywhere from, I would say, $20 to $50 in gold, that's a good trade. But this, we told people buy at 1295 and buy at 1235 if it got there. It didn't get to 1235, so we only have a half of an investment position on. But we were correct in the sense that that range was most likely going to be the bottom for gold, and then it broke out to the upside. 1428 is an upside tactical target that we hit this week. So I suggested to some, if you're long gold from a trading position, you want to take some off at 1428. And we blew through it. The one day we made the high up to, I think was 1442 or so is the high of the move. And then 2 days this week, the high in August futures were a tick under 1428. So that certainly has been the correct level. We closed out at about 1413 or so. On a pullback, I think gold doesn't get less than probably 1350, 1360 if you even get that opportunity. There's no reason to think it should. And from a bigger point of view, where could gold go? Well, I'm probably going to lift my the investment trade, or let's just say the investment, from 1295. My target is 1487, I think it is. And it doesn't mean gold can't go higher than there, but at that point, I've got almost $200 on the trade, and that's, I consider that a very good play. I see no reason why gold is, if we're prognosticating about its future, do I see it taking out the high at 1920? I don't now. I don't know what would make us do that. You'd need, I think, certainly full recession, which I think even if we get some recessionary whiffs in the next year or 2 years, I don't think it becomes a really bad one. So I don't see gold getting up there. Could gold get into the $1,500 or $1,600 range? Sure, it's possible. And look, I won't trade cryptocurrencies, but if you look at what Bitcoin's done and has moved from, $3,500 to as high as $14,000 this year before pulling back a little bit over the last couple of days, there's some message there that there is concern over fiat currency, and that whether it's Bitcoin or gold, you want to be in some other format of a currency versus the actual currencies themselves. So again, I won't trade Bitcoin, but there's a message in what Bitcoin's doing, and that just helps solidify why I kind of want to keep a bullish stance in gold and still look to buy pullbacks.
Yeah, that's fair. One more just quick comment. I just am curious how you read a chart like gold where it did go sideways for 5 to 6 years. Some people call this a U-shaped bottom, and mm-hmm. that argument has been made that that leads to a longer running bull market on the other end. What do you think?
I don't disagree with that. When you have a multi-year U-shaped base like this has, and then it starts breaking out to the upside, go back to a very basic thought that I think most people don't think of in the day-to-day way of looking at markets. If you buy something, whatever the market is, whatever the product is, there's somebody on the other side of that trade. Otherwise, you couldn't have bought because you need a seller. So if you're talking about building a base and a commodity over 5 years, that also means for 5 years you've had sellers. Now, some of those are just people selling out of prior longs, whether they were long lower or long higher, and some of those are speculative shorts. And when you have 5 years worth of shorts that start getting squeezed, that's how a market can rip to the upside, like we've seen recently in gold. So it will have some pauses along the way, but think of it this way: you've got 5 years worth of sellers who are wrong. Now, not everyone has to get out of being wrong because they could just be flat and they'll miss the upside. But the shorts at some point have to get out. Shorts unwinding just create buyers. And the more you go up, the more shorts will be forced to pay and say, get me out at any price. So they just start lifting at the market. They don't care. The pain gets great enough that they say, just buy any price. I don't care. Get me out. And I think that's, now you start looking at a gold chart and you see why 1350-ish somewhere, or even if we got down to 1325, you wouldn't expect it to get a heck of a lot lower than that, because that's kind of the top end of the range. You were saying 1350 to 1380 is where all the highs have been. Well, now we've kind of blown through that. So that means every single seller has been wrong. If you look at a chart now, you have to go back to 2013, the last time gold was trading at where we're trading now. So that's 6 years of people who have bad bets on. And that's also why, if you think of the basic thing in like technical analysis textbooks, that what used to be resistance turns into support. Yeah, so if all the highs were between 1350 and 1380 and you finally blow through them, then you know there's going to be a lot of buyers trying to buy the pullback. And they're going to tend to buy where it broke out from. So I look at the gold chart. I like it. And like I said, you know, tactically, we should stall in here a bit. But I'm a buyer and a pullback.
All right. Well, hey, it's great having you on the show here, Rick. And I enjoy hearing all of these targets that you have for these markets. And that is encouraging for, I think, the gold bulls. Finally, this breakout happening. Everybody, stick around. I'm going to be right back with Mark Chandler. Rick, have a great rest of your weekend.
You too, Corey. Thanks for having me.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Oh, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed my conversation with Rick Bensignor to start off this show. I am now chatting with Mark Chandler, managing partner over at Bannockburn Global Forex. Also writes the Mark to Market blog, which I visit every day. Mark, we're going to skip over this G20 meeting because I don't think there's much more to say. We are simply just waiting to hear what the results are, what the comments are from Trump and Xi. But let's talk about what I think is continuing to drive these markets, and this is Fed easing perceptions. Everybody seems to be pricing in one, and if not more than one, rate cut this year. But when we look around, it just doesn't still seem like stuff in the U.S. is that bad. Yes, some of the recent economic data has definitely been trending in the wrong direction, but you look at the markets, U.S. markets are at or close to all-time highs. What do you think, Mark? Do you think that right now you could consider the expectations, almost peak easing expectations for the Fed?
Yeah, that's how I think we are. I mean, there's four meetings that the Fed has in the second half of the year. The market is pricing in a 75 basis point cut. And I think that there are still some people who talk about 50 basis points. But after a recent comments by Powell, the chairman, and by Bullard, who's the St. Louis Fed president, the only one to dissent from this last meeting in favor of an immediate cut, is not so dovish that he wants to support a 50 basis point move. I kind of think of it like this, that matters how you conceive of the situation. What will the Fed do? Will they give us an insurance policy like they did in the late 90s, late in the business cycle? Even though the stock market, I think, was up about 20% when they gave us that rate cut then, the idea is that you just take out an insurance policy, just extend the business cycle. On the other hand, what the market seems to be pricing in is a beginning of an easing cycle, not just an insurance policy, but a more serious, sustained campaign. Now, what's interesting is the market has three cuts priced in, but the Wall Street Journal Dow Jones did a survey this week, and they found that economists, not the same as investors, too poor to be investors, that the economist looks for only two cuts this year. And so I think that we're at that point where it's hard to imagine the market pricing in four cuts. There'd be a cut at every meeting. That would be just, I think that would require greater deterioration of the economy than we're seeing. And when everything's said and done, what are we really seeing? You know, at the end of last week, we had the personal consumption expenditures. And this is the 70% or 65% of the economy. And the U.S. consumer, the past 3 months, so this would be March, April, and May data, the strongest 3 months since the crisis, since the great crisis in 2009. And so we got consumers still doing well. Unemployment is at, say, call it 50-year lows. You've got financial conditions, stock market near record highs, bond yields low, not seeing the kind of financial stress. You know, those large banks pass the Fed stress test, and that gives them the right to basically return a lot of capital to investors. And when I say a lot, I mean $175 billion in stock buybacks and dividends. So I just don't see the urgency or the compelling need to begin a big easing cycle.
That's a crazy stat to think about, that much money could be coming out of the banks being returned to investors in the form of dividends. I think it's reasonable to expect that a lot of that money will end up back in the markets. But Mark, even though, yes, we're not seeing the worst data from the U.S., there has been a general downtrend in some of the recent data. We haven't heard the Fed use that data-dependent term so much as they did anymore, but they are continuing to point to inflation, which is, quite frankly, stuck. And that is also being used as one of the reasons why they will ease further. How do you think that's playing into it? One, inflation, and two, this general downtrend in some of the data.
Yeah, we have seen, it looks like this, that the we have a lot of soft data. And by that, I mean like the survey data for June. And so it does look like the second quarter ended on a soft note. But we'll see the jobs data coming after the 4th of July. And I think they will see that was a bit of a fluke, the weakness of the past month. And I think they will see the earnings stay strong. I do think that the Fed is couching their talk about easing in terms of inflation, sort of undershooting their target. It is, of course, it's soft. We're talking about 1.5, 1.6% on the PCE deflator that the Fed targets. I'm not so sure that that's a problem, though. I mean, because it's sort of like, at what price does it cost us to address that? And I'm still thinking that the Fed, because we're overshooting on unemployment, that is, unemployment is below where the Fed says it can be in a sustained basis in the long term. And so if we undershoot on the unemployment, doesn't it let us undershoot on inflation for a while and without having to take big policy actions? And I tell you, what still concerns me, and I don't know exactly how it works out this way, but I think that somehow the Federal Reserve are going to back ourselves back into this cycle. And the cycle runs something like this. It is not what the Fed tells us. It's not what conventional wisdom that the Fed kills recoveries. The last recovery I can think the Fed purposely killed was in the early 1980s. And that was with Paul Volcker and a double-digit inflation we had from the late 70s, early 80s. But since then, the crisis, the economic crisis that of our generation that we've had to live through as adults, the great financial crisis, it was not that monetary policy was too tight. The crisis before that was a tech bubble. Monetary policy wasn't too tight then either. And then early in my career, I can say it's early now. At the time, it didn't seem that way. We had the savings and loan crisis. And again, that wasn't too easy a Fed policy. So I think by the Fed somehow being squeezed back into this easier policy, partly because of the headwinds caused by the U.S. trade policy, I just get concerned that we're going to trigger some other financial excesses. And I'm not sure those financial excesses are where everybody looks. Like right now, everybody's looking at the CLO, the collateralized loan market, or the all the double B corporate bonds. And of course, crisis can happen there. I just think that the crisis typically takes place where we're not looking at it, places where not everybody, where the Wall Street Journal is not putting headlines together, you know, every other day, that kind of thing. And I'm just not sure what that is yet.
Yeah, that is very true, that usually these crises do come out of areas that people aren't looking at. But right now, we just have these comments of this everything bubble, where it seems like there are excesses across the board in the financial markets. That being said, I do want to touch on the environment, again, that we are seeing where risk on and risk off are moving higher. Bonds are up there, the 10-year right around 2%. Bonds have been screaming higher, but have taken a little bit of a breather here. U.S. equity markets at or near all-time highs, but then also gold this month in what is typically a slow month for gold has moved over $100 from its low to its high. It was $130. That's also picking up some momentum. So where is the reward going to come from for the rest of this year, possibly?
Yeah, so I think that how you framed it, I think that's the way a lot of people are seeing this. Bonds are telling us one thing, and they're telling us that things are not looking so good. And maybe it's not just today, but going forward. On the other hand, people seem to not get enough of equities. But I think that there could be like a common ground here. And I think that common ground is that what the market's telling us, I think, is that interest rates will stay lower for longer. That is the message we're getting from the central banks, it seems. And I think the market, so one idea, right, is that this is not sustainable. I mean, I think we have almost a little bit more than $13 trillion of negative yielding bonds. This past week, Austria sold a bond 5 years. They had a lower interest rate than the ECB's deposit rate, which is minus 40 basis points. It's like the first time that's happened. They have a 100-year bond. Listen to this, the 100-year bond in Austria is yielding about 120 basis points. And so I think that the idea that I'm getting is that interest rates stay lower for longer, and that means that there's nothing to do with your money but buy stocks. But if you're going to have a low interest rate environment for a prolonged period of time, that this might really turn out to be sustainable. I mean, Japan has had near zero overnight interest rates for the bulk of my career. And it's still, people say, not sustainable, but there it is, 20 years later. And so I think that if interest rates stay low for longer, that some things like gold, which in their natural form do not have a yield stream, it might even cost you, if you buy the bullion, it might cost you to store it and insure it. But when you have minus 40 basis point yield in Europe, you're looking at the 10-year German Bund at minus 30 basis points. Negative yielding bonds, and so much of them, makes the opportunity cost of gold cheaper. It makes it more gold more attractive. And in my work, I'm worried about the geopolitics, not just Iran, but I'm worried that we're on the verge of the second Cold War, that just like we have these forks in the Bitcoin, I think we get a fork in the internet, in globalization, and there's going to be a Chinese way. It'll be primarily for Chinese citizens, people who live in China, maybe some of the countries next to them. And then there'll be the U.S. way, which is still has a duopoly on, say, mobile operating systems, the OIS and and Android. So I think that gold looks attractive. I'm not a gold bug, but for the second, third time in my career, I'm bullish on gold. I can see it going from this $1,400 that was sort of consolidating above this breakout to maybe $1,700. And that's a 20% move. And maybe it doesn't all come this year, but I think that when I look around the market and say, where can I see 20% reasonable return? And right now, gold jumps out at me.
Okay. Hey, that means a lot to, I think, or it should mean a lot to the gold investors, that even someone like yourself is seeing that risk reward much in the favor of gold in the short term. I think it's also been encouraging for those gold investors to see some of the more volatility move in rather than just $1 or $2 moves a day. We started to see double digit dollar wise moves every day. Mark, what about next week, though? We always look ahead to some of the data or news that could drive markets. Yes, we're going to be getting some of the fallout from that G20 meeting. But what about next week? It is a shortened trading week across North America.
Yeah, so here's what I'm looking at. I think that the Canadian data, the GDP numbers we saw at the end of last week, I think that Canada is one of the few central banks that's legitimately not thinking about easing. I think most other central banks in the major countries thinking about easing, maybe the Bank of England an exception just because of Brexit. And Norway is the big exception as well. They are still in a hiking mode. But I think for the other countries, Canada stands out as being like solidly on neutral. I'm kind of thinking that the Canadian dollar might have been played out here. It rallied, I think, 130.50, 130.60, some important retracement areas there. But so I'll be looking at the economic data for next week. The most important probably will be the U.S. jobs data, partly because we had that soft report previously. But Canada also reports the trade numbers as well as the jobs data at the end of next week. And barring a big surprise, I mean, Canada has been having these really record job growth. And I think that it would have to take a big negative to really like break people of that view. And I think that the The early call looks for another modest gain in the employment. In the U.S., we should get something back closer to trend, and that's going to be important because just again taking off that risk of a 50 basis point move. So what are we looking at? We had that May number, 75,000 increase, and I think people are looking for something closer to trend. Trend is around 170,000, 180,000, and so I'd look for something just below there. The reason I say just below there is we've been seeing a little bit of softness in some of the weekly jobless claim numbers. It's our weekly numbers. They don't always dovetail nicely, but just tells us there might be a little bit of downside there.
All right, Mark, it's great having you on the show. I think we might actually explore that concept that you just shared, too, about the fork in the internet and how we could be seeing different avenues and different countries controlling different areas of that internet. That's a whole other conversation. But again, some good comments dealing with Fed easing, central bank easing, and where some of the last recessions and true financial excesses have come from. Mark, great chatting with you. Have a great rest of your weekend, my friend.
Thanks. Good luck, everybody.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
Oh, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody has enjoyed those first two segments. More focus kind of generally on markets as well as diving into the gold sector. In this segment, I am chatting with Sean Broderick. He is an editor over at Weiss Ratings, writes a number of different newsletters, a couple that I pay close attention to, the Marijuana Millionaire Portfolio and the Super Cycle Investor. Sean, let's start off by talking about the gold sector, with gold finally getting a breakout and moving above a level or hitting highs that it hasn't seen in 5 and 6 years. I want us to dive down into some of the stocks, because you can still make the argument that the stocks are lagging. Some of the bigger miners have started to move, which is typical for kind of a new bull market for the precious metals. But what are you keying in on in terms of stocks, gold stocks, that you are either adding to your recommendations or at least considering?
Right. Well, I'm looking for those stocks that can control their costs and are also growing their production organically, if possible. That would tend to rule out a bunch of stocks. So, I mean, it's not like you want to rule out anything. But those are the things I like. I have to tell you, though, those stocks that will go up the fastest are those that were either losing money at like recent prices or else just barely making money, because their profit margins widen tremendously, or else they start making a profit for the first time in a long time. And so those are the ones that catapult higher. However, those also come with some risk, because when you have a pullback, right, you know that those will collapse. I like to sleep at night. So I like stocks with a good fundamental basis that are growing organically, that have top management. But I also like some explorers as well. And those are performing tremendously too. One thing we haven't seen in this large move yet is we haven't seen silver start to outperform gold. We haven't seen silver miners start to outperform the gold miners. And that's important, because that's usually a sign of a bull market, is when silver outperforms gold. We haven't seen that yet. So either we're wrong or else we're still very early stages. I believe we're still very early stages and the big run in silver is yet to come. But that's not stopping me from buying silver miners either. Just to give you some examples of like some of the stocks we've added in the past month, we have First Majestic Silver. That's up tremendously. We have AngloGold Ashanti, a great global gold miner, the number three producer in the world. It is closing mines in South Africa, and it's really keeping a lid on its costs. It's doing great, great stuff. We own Pretium Gold, which rides a roller coaster when it comes out with its earnings reports, but dang, that's doing very, very well for us right now. We have wheat and precious metals because you should always have a streamer, and that really is probably the best one. We have SSR Mining, which used to be Silver Standard Mining, but then they became more of a gold producer, and so they like changed their name. And those are the kind of stocks that are really good at controlling costs. They either have new projects coming online or else they're doing some other kind of organic growth. They have great management. Those are among the ones that I find really interesting right now. Those are the ones that I've already given to my subscribers. One last one would be Kirkland Lake. We've been riding that horse for a while and doing very, very well. Some people might say it's overbought at this point. You know, the symbol is a KL. Anyone can look at it. It's had a great run. I can see why you might hesitate to buy it now. We bought it a long time ago. But dang, that has super high grades. Oh, I also look for high grades because high grades cover up a lot of problems, and there's always a problem in gold mining. So that has high grades. It has growing production. It has organic growth. Kirkland Lake, there's nothing not to like about it. So those are the kind of companies that I'm looking at.
Plus, yeah, just look at that stock chart for Kirkland Lake. And if you've been riding that for a while, man, you're doing very, very well. But you did outline, you know, some of the royalty streaming companies. Those have been doing well for a while. And those large miners, you did mention something there that I think is crucial. And that is all about keeping costs under control. Because in bull markets, unfortunately, costs also escalate for some companies almost just as fast as, let's say, the gold price can. What are some of the aspects that you key on to get an understanding if companies are actually controlling their costs?
Well, you just look at the year-over-year all-in sustaining costs. Now, that said, we have to understand the companies fudge those things enough that you could probably drive a truck through them, but you can see a trend in a company's cost structure. It's also important, by the way, there are some producing miners that still issue shares, usually to make purchase of like some kind of project or else something like that, that will be punished in any market correction. So you have to be very careful. Is the company you're looking at the kind of company that issues shares a lot? Because if it is, let me tell you, that is going to hurt it big time. So stay away from those. You like companies with cash flow, or at least I do. I mean, one I don't own, but I'm looking at right now would be a B2 Gold. I mean, that has tremendous cash flow. I'd like to buy it on a pullback. I may not get that chance. It like operates around Africa. It has great mines and cash flow. Cash flow will really allow these companies to, when they want to buy new projects, they don't have to issue new shares. So definitely look for that.
Okay, one other quick comment regarding some of these larger companies. One topic that's been on everyone's mind for a while now has been debt levels. How much do you key on in long-term, short-term debt levels of some of these major miners?
Yeah, well, the ones I buy have to have a plan in place to actually reduce their debt levels. AngloGold Ashanti is an example of that. They have debt. They absolutely do, you know, and so that might make some people blanch, but they're actively working to reduce that debt and looking stronger because of it. We can have a whole conversation about good debt and bad debt and like stuff like that, but they just have to have a plan and they have to be working that plan. Those companies that, I mean, I can think of some outside the gold space that make acquisitions that just don't make any sense. Actually, I can think of some inside the gold space, but let's not throw stones at like this point. But, you know, sometimes they make an acquisition that you look at like what they're acquiring with that debt and like you're thinking, wow, things really have to go right for that project to work. You know, like say they're going to pick up some project that maybe has been mismanaged in the past and they think they can run it better and maybe they can. But maybe they can't. And so be really careful what they're using that debt for. That's all I'd say.
Okay, final comment here regarding gold companies. You talked about production being key and making money. Is there a certain level that you like to see in terms of production? A lot of people talk about 100,000 ounces of gold production a year. Do you care about that level?
Well, that seems to be what the market looks at as some kind of magic number. I actually look at production growth. And of course, you might be thinking, well, the guy owns AngloGold Ashanti and they aren't growing production. That's true. They have other things that are actually going for them. But in most of the miners I look at production growth or the potential for production growth. Do they have a new project that they plan to bring online in like 6 months, 9 months down the road? Because that's what the market will probably fixate on, that they have some new honeypot coming on that is just going to be great for their earnings. So look at what they have in their pipeline. I think that's very, very important.
All right, let's also switch focus to the cannabis sector. You and I have been covering the cannabis sector now for a number of months and discussing some of the companies that interest us and some of the areas where you see a sweet spot. I think we can say generally cannabis stocks have been trying to sell off, but no way have they been just flat out breaking down. An interesting thing that you pointed out to me off mic is that acquisitions have been generally getting sold. Whenever a company announces an acquisition, their stock has been pressed down a little bit in terms of the share price. What do you think this is telling you about the cannabis sector?
Well, this really tells me that investors, probably larger investors, believe these companies are overpaying. The Flower Corporation is an excellent example, and I can talk about this one because my subscribers used to own it, and they took profits, and we don't own it anymore. But then it announced that it was making an acquisition on Wednesday, and its stock went down by 18%. So that's a heck of a move to the downside. And I'm looking at it. It didn't look like a bad acquisition to me, but obviously the market disagrees. Now, one thing that really hurts these companies is there's a lot of hot money in the sector anyway, right? It's all sloshing around. And so hot money really tends to get scared by anything. It just spooks. And so if you come out with something that isn't like immediately accretive to the bottom line, people are just going to get spooked and run out the door. And then you have, say, companies like Canopy Growth that aren't making any money, don't seem to be having the opportunity to make money anytime in the next 2 years. Why are you buying that stock? Now, I can't think of good reasons to buy it. I don't own it. My subscribers don't own it. But if it got cheap enough, I would buy it. But on the other hand, if it has no earnings and it just seems to keep spending money, at some point that share price is going to correct. So people think these stocks are overvalued anyway. They think that when they make these acquisitions, they are paying too much. And it's an extremely volatile industry filled with hot money that just sloshes around and runs out of things when people are scared. You put those together and you can have some jaw-dropping corrections. But if the underlying business of a particular company is sound, you might look at those corrections as a chance to pick it up.
Well, and that's the thing, though, isn't it? As much as people keep on saying these cannabis companies are overvalued, it's not like we're seeing a flood out of the sector. We are seeing a rotation, and quite frankly, people are still paying attention. So, I don't know, sometimes that sentiment, right, when people say that something is overvalued, it's almost that climbing that wall of worry that we can see happen for a prolonged period of time.
I would absolutely agree, and also, as bad as sentiment has been recently, and believe me, I launched a newsletter. I'm seeing how bad it can be. I am seeing things kind of firm up now. And so I think that perhaps some of the worries about all the hot air in the sector have been rectified. I think at least select companies can actually see their way forward to actually making money in the next year or two. Those are some that I would keep my eye on, because it is important that at some point they will start making money, but what's their plan beyond that? What's their growth plan? I mean, they can't just make money. They have to have a plan to keep growing at a very fast pace. There are select companies that are actually well positioned in this industry to do just that, to grow very quickly. And so I think there's tremendous opportunities out there. People just have to be aware of it, and they have to be willing to take some lumps in the short term, because the long term, like payoff, could be quite extraordinary.
All right, John, we're going to wrap it up there. But, hey, good comments on two sectors that do get a lot of attention still on our show. But I do appreciate driving down into some of the stocks and what you're looking for. It's encouraging to see this gold breakout. And I think for all those cannabis investors, still encouraging to see this, well, massive amount of money that is still, for the most part, remaining in that sector. Sean, great chatting with you. If anybody wants more information on any of Sean's newsletters, please email me, fleck@kereport.com, and I am happy to put you in touch with Sean and his team over at Weiss Ratings. Sean, thanks for your time today, buddy.
Thanks very much.
Welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are switching our focus to the energy, more specifically oil market, with our good friend Joseph Schachter. He is the founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report. And Joseph, let's first just quickly talk about the oil price. Crude touching or coming very close to that $60 a barrel level, closed the week just slightly below there. But I know from being a subscriber of your newsletter that you are expecting a general decline in the crude price to somewhere below 50. Can you please share why and what your targets are?
Yeah, the market reacted to, of course, Trump's tweets about, you know, that they're getting closer. Well, it was more Mnuchin and Lighthizer of the Trump administration saying they were 90% of the way getting a deal. A lot of people were worried that if there wasn't a deal, that it would drag out and that would slow down world economies. We've been seeing slower growth numbers from a lot of companies. We're hearing a lot of companies talk about, you know, for second quarter earnings are going to be disappointing. The guidance on that will start coming out with the earnings in the next few weeks. Second week of July on, you start seeing the massive influx of Q2 results. Same time, U.S. inventories were getting near the top of the five-year band. This week, we had a decline because U.S. Imports came down sharply. And interestingly, the big decline in imports came from Canada. So we weren't shipping as much by rail, and we weren't shipping as much by pipe. That was a disappointment to the market there. But the price of oil backed off at the end of last week, Friday, to $58.18. Down $1.25 on Friday. And my guess is that if we start seeing that the drawdowns during the early part of summer are not that strong because the heat wave in the States doesn't, people don't go on holiday and drive anywhere, that we're going to see the inventories not come down as fast as expected. And then we're also going to probably see during Q3 the beginning of the new pipelines coming on. So U.S. production, which was 12.1 million last week on the EIA data, is the high water mark was 12.4 million barrels. That number could get back, should get over that 12.4 during Q3, and potentially could be more than 13, maybe even as high as 14 million during Q4. That build in inventory would cause a build in inventory, and that would be a reason for the price of oil to go down. The other part, of course, is if the G20 doesn't have a firm, conclusive deal, but just says they're going to keep on talking, I think the, you know, President Trump doesn't want a deal right now. I think he wants to drag this out into Q1, Q2 of next year, then get a deal. And then, of course, then he ride that into the election win or to a potential election win. So my view is that unless he gets a fabulous deal offer from China, this thing drags out, and that will make people nervous about, is there going to be a slowing in the U.S. economy and world economies?
Yeah, I'm of the mindset that we are not going to get any deal. We are recording this later in the day on Friday, so I'm sure there will be some news. But overall, too, Joseph, even if or when we do get some sort of a trade deal, isn't the fact of the matter still that the world globally is stuck in kind of a slow growth mentality? So any sort of major runs in the crude price would have to come from almost shocks to the supply side.
Yeah, and that's what the market was betting on, was that maybe this Iran thing would get worse. Maybe the Iranian Revolutionary Guard would have more of their speedboats attacking, shipping in the area. The United States, of course, has said that they would send more equipment, more naval equipment, and they could always just do convoys with other OECD nations to protect the shipping lanes. He did attack, the American military did attack with cyber warfare against, military targets in Iran. And maybe that's enough for them to realize, he held back, but at some point he won't hold back. And, you've got to be careful. And then, of course, he did more sanctions against some of the leaders. So those are the ways he's doing it now, rather than, being responsible for more deaths and then also being responsible for potentially escalating into a war situation when they're trying to get out of Syria and they're trying to get out of Afghanistan. And he doesn't need a new war in Iran to be one of the legacies of his presidency.
So also regarding the oil price and the oil stocks, the stocks are generally lagging, such as we're seeing in a number of different resource sectors. Is that what also is contributing to maybe some of your thoughts that oil could pull back here?
Yeah, I think if oil does pull back, some of these stocks will come lower. We're sitting with a lot, the index, the S&P TSX Energy Index at 139 on the close on Friday. That was 143, 144. The high in April, in the third week of April, when the price of oil was 66.60, and I mentioned to you at the time that I thought we were going lower, the price of oil has come down. The index got down to the low 130s and bounced. But I think on this rally to $60, but I think we're going to go down to the low 130s. So potentially there's a 5 to 7% decline on the market, but many stocks are trading near their 52-week lows. And so there's a lot of bargains out there, but could they get cheaper? Yes. So I would hold your powder dry. I think we're going to see the S&P, the S&P bullish energy bullish percentage index, which was 31 earlier in the week, get down to below 10% and maybe below 5%. Some point when this market shakeout occurs, and that will be another table pounding buying opportunity, just like we got in November, December of 2018.
Okay, I want to also focus a little bit north of the border, up here in Canada, and the news this week regarding that Trans Mountain pipeline running through BC. It looks like now we're back in the green light, outside of that red light stage that we were in. Do you think this will have any impact on the overall oil market, and what do you think about this ongoing spat between BC and the rest of Canada?
My biggest concern is that this is a political football. The pipeline portion in Alberta will not be a problem to build. The pipeline portion going into the lower mainland, that is along where the indigenous groups have said, yes, we want the pipeline, we want to buy the pipeline, we want jobs for our people along and permanently along the pipeline route. The problem is, and that can happen with construction starting in September, problem is that means you have a very short construction window in 2019, because once you get into the winter, it ends. So you really got September, October, and part of November, which isn't going to get a lot done. So you need to be a go-ahead next March, April, when winter's over, and be ready to move quickly then. The problem is, late October, we have a federal election. And so if Trudeau is going to be losing market share in terms of MPs, in eastern Canada, the battleground for the win is going to be BC. And if he is beholden to BC Liberals that are elected and to the Green Party, or, he wins votes from the NDP, then, for him to get over the majority government or to a minority, which is beholden to the Green Party to be staying in power, to get in power, my view is, and we don't see the finalization of the pipeline, and then the egress issues become even more problematic. And that's the basic concern in Alberta, is that, yes, you got the go-ahead here, but that doesn't mean that there can't be a bit of a roller coaster ride here until after the election. If in the end the Conservatives win and the Liberals go down to defeat, then it's likely that we will see the pipeline built. And, of course, then we'll see LNG Canada happen. So, the reality is, if you want resource development in this country, the federal government has to change.
Yeah, your term political football is spot on with that pipeline. But overall, Joseph, it doesn't sound like you see, let's say, the oil market falling out of bed. It's more just waiting for a pullback, a buying opportunity, and trying to ride that maybe late summer wave higher in the oil stocks and sector.
Yeah, I think that the bargains that we're going to get in the next month or two are ones you want to take advantage of, because I believe that we're going to see $70 oil in 2020. And I think in 2021, the construction season that TransCanada's had every summer will be over. So natural gas prices will start firming up. And then as you get closer to LNG Canada coming on stream in 2023, 2024, you're going to have gas ready to go into that pipeline. So the companies that are behind it are going to have to be drilling, and they're going to have to be tying down gas to go into that pipeline. So my guess is that we're going to be looking at both oil and natural gas prices together firming up in 2020. And then by 2022, 2023, I think we're going to see $100 oil and north of $3 gas. If that's happening, this industry is going to be coining gigantic amounts of money. And instead of the foreigners running away from Canada, they're going to be coming into Canada because of, number one, we do have LNG exports starting. Number two, hopefully a change in government that makes the signage up, welcome to Canada, to the international energy investors and energy industry. And then lastly, people will be seeing that the pipelines are being built. And so you go from hating the stocks and them trading at record low valuations, price to cash flow, price to NAV, price to adjusted numbers, and trading below PDP, proved developed producing reserves. And then we get back into where the markets are willing to pay for more than 1P, paying part of proved plus probable. And then, of course, you see stocks that could be up 5 or 10 times. So you want to be able to take advantage of when they're throwing them away. Right now, they're cheap, but they're not into distress levels or throwing away in many cases. I think we're going to go see them that lower. The other thing is there's some dividend payers here that are fabulous, that are trading at 9% plus yields, where the dividends, I believe, are very secure, and managements have said they're very secure. And so for individual investors, we cover those in our newsletter. People can go to our website and see some information on that. And the reality is that there's some very high quality, high dividend yielding payers. So you can afford to wait for the turn in the cycle, because you're getting paid much better than you can in almost every other dividend paying security while you wait. The industry is so hated that dividend yields in many companies are 9 to 10%.
Yeah, wow. That's great yielding investments right there. Joseph, great having you on the show. Everyone, if you do want more information on Joseph's newsletter, Schachter Energy Report, you can email me for more information. I can put you in touch with Joseph and his team. Everybody, thank you for tuning in to the weekend edition. I hope everyone in Canada has a great Canada Day long weekend. Everyone in the U.S., July 4th. Joseph, thanks again for your time. Have a great weekend as well.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.